This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. And that is a sound ornithologists longed to hear in the 19th century. It's a Kirtland's warbler singing on its nesting grounds. But for more than 50 years, nobody knew where the songbird nested. Its range was almost exclusively in northern Michigan, among the jack pines between Kalkaska and Alpena. Our understanding of the Kirtland's warbler developed just in time to save it from extinction, and today the population is estimated at more than 2,000 birds. It will soon come off the endangered species list, and that will create a new set of issues, as the bird now depends on people to survive. Bill Rapay tells the story of the Kirtland's warbler in his book, The Kirtland's Warbler, the story of a bird's fight against extinction and the people who saved it. It was a Michigan notable book for 2012. And Bill joins us from the studios at WDET in Detroit. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Peter.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. If I can't be in northern Michigan, this is the second best thing.
The next best thing. It sounds like you are.
Yep.
And let me tell our listeners, we're still having trouble with our phone system, so you have to use the local phone line, which means if someone else is on it, it might be busy. But if you want to join in our conversation this morning with Bill, the number is 231-276-4412. So, Bill, tell us a little bit about how this bird was so elusive in the back part of the 19th century and puzzled ornithologists about its whereabouts when it was time to lay eggs.
Well, obviously, the population was so small that it was very difficult to find. Charles Pease shot the first Kirtland's warbler in 1851 on his father-in-law's farm east of Cleveland. He was a bird collector and an ornithologist, and he had this bird in his hand that he had no idea what it was, but he did know what to do with it, and that was give it to his father-in-law, Dr. Jared P. Kirtland. Kirtland, by all accounts, was an extraordinary man. He was a young graduate of the Yale Medical School. He was a physician. He was a horticulturalist. He was an expert on snakes and mussels. He was an expert on mammals in Ohio. But for all of his knowledge about the birds and the animals of northern Ohio, he couldn't identify this bird either. So a few days later, he was able to give it to Spencer Baird, who took it back to the Smithsonian with him, and he couldn't identify it from all the birds that were in the Smithsonian. So the next year, Baird wrote a paper in the Scientific Journal proclaiming this was a new species of bird, and that he named it after Kirtland because of all of Kirtland's contributions to our knowledge of the animals of Ohio. So 50 years pass, and we know very, very little about the Kirtland's warbler. We've had a few sightings in North America. They've discovered that the Kirtland's warbler pretty much nests in the Bahamas because bird collectors were going into the Bahamas every winter and coming out with Kirtland's warblers, but they couldn't find it in North America. So it became sort of an ornithological guessing game. Where did the Kirtland's warbler actually nest? We knew a lot about the birds of North America because of the previous century. We spread out across North America and we learned just about every species that was out there, except for the Kirtland's warbler. And people began to say, well, where is this bird? Why do we have so few numbers of them? Until ornithologists got a break in 1903, which is when a young man who was on a fishing expedition along the Ossabaw River heard birds singing, so he asked his fishing partner to shoot it, and he brought it back to the University of Michigan with him. He was a student at the University of Michigan. He worked in the Museum of Natural History there, and he presented it to the curator of birds at the University of Michigan, Norman Wood. Wood immediately recognized it as a Kirtland's warbler and made plans to go north to see if he could find the Kirtland's warbler nesting grounds. So in 1903, in June of 1903, he took a train north from Ann Arbor to Roscommon. He took a boat up the Ossabaw River. He went on foot and by wagon until he finally found the Kirtland's warbler nesting grounds. He crossed over the Ossabaw River to the area where his student said that he found it, and he heard a singing Kirtland's warbler. Of course, to make sure of it, the first thing he did was shoot it. It's important to remember that science back then was done at the business end of a shotgun, and museums and bird collectors would think nothing about shooting a bird at that time to learn more about it. So this was a major scientific breackthrough for ornithologists in North America, because finally the last bird that we knew very, very little about, we finally understood where the Kirtland's warbler nested.
And why was it so rare at that time? There are different reasons that the population has gone up and down over the past century. What do we know about what was happening with the bird when they were first figuring out where it was nesting?
The Kirtland's warbler is always going to be a rare bird simply because of its persnickety habits. You could, a robin, you can find a robin nesting just about anywhere. You can find cardinals and other birds nesting just about anywhere. The Kirtland's warbler really has a specific place that it wants to nest. It wants to nest on sandy soil, underneath young jack pine trees, and there's very few places around North America where you can find that combination. And one of those places where you can find that combination is northern Michigan. And the range is very, very small of areas that contain that amount of habitat for them. That habitat was created after the Wisconsin Glacier withdrew about 12,000 years ago, and it left these wonderful sandy areas between Oscoda and Grayling and a little bit to the west of Oscoda, a little bit to the west of Grayling into Kalkaska and Grand Traverse County, and a little bit north into Mount Morenci County. But there's not a whole lot of range for the birds to find for their nesting grounds. So it's always going to have a limited population.
So where did the birds nest when this region was covered in glaciers?
Your guess is as good as mine, Peter. Speculation, and it's purely speculation, that they nested in southern United States, what is now the southern United States, in the Pine Belt across Georgia and Alabama. But nobody really knows for certain. But the Kirtland's warbler DNA has been traced back a million years. So obviously this bird was around back then, and it probably made its way north again when the glacier receded, and it found a home in the jack pine plains of northern Michigan.
The recent observation of a few Kirtland's warblers nesting in Wisconsin, was that a lowering of the bird's standards of breeding grounds, or did it find the exact habitat it likes over in Wisconsin?
I certainly like to think that it's lowering its standards by going to Wisconsin, but there's a very small population in Wisconsin, and there's about 23 birds that have been seen in Wisconsin. And over in Wisconsin, they're nesting on sandy soils, yes, but they're also nesting under a combination of red and jack pines. Where they're being found in Wisconsin is actually on private land that's owned by a timber company. And the timber company really likes to have red pines because red pines are more profitable for them. So the red pine doesn't provide the perfect habitat for Kirtland's warblers, because as the red pine gets a little bit older, it loses its lower branches. And the Kirtland's warbler really likes the lower branches to be overlapping, because it nests on the ground in sandy soil, and it wants to have the protection from those lower branches.
Now, in your book, you tell us that there have been two points in the last 50 years at which the number of Kirtland's warblers was estimated to be below 400. And I think the first was in the early 70s. And at least a big part of the problem at that point was the cowbird, which is a parasitic bird, which is a concept maybe people won't be familiar with. What is the cowbird, and what does it do to the Kirtland's warbler?
The brown-headed cowbird developed its nesting strategy by following the bison across the Great Plains back for thousands of years. And they would had a somewhat symbiotic relationship with the bison. They would pick the insects off the bison, and when the bison would wander across the plains, they would knock up insects, which the cowbirds would eat. But the bison also move up to 20 miles a day. So instead of taking the time to stop and raise their young, build a nest, raise their young, the cowbird decided, hey, what we're going to do here is we're going to just lay an egg in another bird's nest and move along with the bison, and we're going to leave our egg to be raised by that other bird. And it's been a very successful strategy. Other bird species have developed techniques to defend against the bison, or excuse me, to defend against the brown-headed cowbird. But when the brown-headed cowbird actually moved into northern Michigan, the Kirtland's warbler had no experience with the brown-headed cowbird. It didn't co-evolve with the brown-headed cowbird, and therefore it had no defense. It did not recognize the threat from the brown-headed cowbird. If you look at a Kirtland's warbler egg and a brown-headed cowbird egg side by side, they're almost identical. The brown-headed cowbird egg is slightly larger, but otherwise they're both the same color and they have the same types of speckles on them. And it's really amazing how you would think, well, a Kirtland's warbler would lay four eggs, and the mother Kirtland's warbler would come back to the nest and say, well, wait a minute, there's that fifth egg. Where did that come from? Well, what happens is the cowbird comes in, it lays its egg, and it removes one of the Kirtland's warbler eggs. So when the Kirtland's warbler comes back, it still sees four eggs, and it doesn't recognize that the brown-headed cowbird has laid its own egg in the nest. The impact of the brown-headed cowbird is very dramatic. If you get one brown-headed cowbird egg in the nest, perhaps two Kirtland's warblers in a clutch of five will survive. If you get two brown-headed cowbirds in a nest, none of the Kirtland's warblers will survive. And in the late 1970s, Lawrence Walkinshaw did a study of the impact of the brown-headed cowbird on the Kirtland's warbler and found that there was less than one Kirtland's warbler surviving per nest. If you run the biologists at the time ran all kinds of population models, and they realized that the Kirtland's warbler simply could not sustain its population if they were hatching less than one bird per nest per year.
And so this is where humans have been very helpful by trapping cowbirds and
absolutely
making a huge difference in the success of the Kirtland's warbler at reproducing.
Right. If you drive through Kirtland's warbler country in the nesting grounds, there are actually traps that are being built. Cowbirds are gregarious birds. And if they fly into the area and they see a trap, they see brown-headed cowbirds inside the trap, they see water and food inside the trap, they'll say, well, look at that. Let's go inside the trap and have some food and be with our friends. And they go in and they can't get out. Of course, once they're caught, Mike Petrushka, who was a volunteer many years ago with the brown-headed cowbird trapping effort, he said that they would send the brown-headed cowbirds to a different habitat.
That's what that's what he would tell visitors when he was giving tours and talking.
Yes.
With, general.
Yes,
general
of course,
population.
It was a euphemism. It was a euphemism for destroying the birds and burying them. There are three different ways of killing a brown-headed cowbird, which are approved, but I won't go into those. I don't know if it's germane.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure why you went into them in your book. It was a little gruesome.
But it's a little gruesome, but it's also a little humorous. In that, you know, there's a certain amount of karma there. That if you, you know, try to kill a bird in a certain way, it gets its revenge.
And how many brown cowbirds, or did you say, is it brown-headed? Is that the term?
Brown-headed cowbird, yes.
How many are volunteers and wildlife agents taking out of northern Michigan in traps these days?
Thousands, literally thousands. Over the years, they have taken several thousand cowbirds out of the northern Michigan population. And one trap really is able to cover about 5 square miles. So you don't need that many traps. And once the cowbird traps were installed, the parasitic impact on the Kirtland's warbler was huge. The population of the every 10 years from 1951 to 1971, there was a census done of the Kirtland's warbler. And in 1971, the census showed that it took a tremendous fall in population. And the biologists and the bird watchers got together in a meeting in Ann Arbor, and they said, it's time to do something about the brown-headed cowbird, the impact of the brown-headed cowbird. And once that happened, once they began to trap the cowbirds and take them out of the habitat, the Kirtland's warbler population began to grow significantly.
And let me say, you're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm talking with Bill Rapay. He's the author of the book, The Kirtland's Warbler, The Story of a Bird's Fight Against Extinction and the People who saved It, published by the University of Michigan Press. If you want to join us this morning, you could do so. You have to use the local line today. That number is 231-276-4412, 231-276-4412. Now, the piece of the history of this bird that is just totally bizarre has to do with the cowbirds, and that is that the first person to really document this, and as I gather from your book, create what became a fairly famous exhibit of a nest with a cowbird egg in it, was Nathan Leopold of the Leopold and Loeb fame, the two young intellectual men who killed a boy in Chicago in the early part of the 20th century, apparently just for amusement. Tell us about Nathan Leopold's role in all this.
Nathan Leopold was a brilliant young man from Chicago who went to school at the University of Michigan. And he was an ornithologist at a very young age. He was an outstanding bird watcher. He was a member of the American Ornithologist Union. He was just, he had a bright, bright future as an ornithologist or a lawyer or whatever it was that he wanted to be. So at the University of Michigan, he's studying birds with Norman Wood. And Wood sees a brilliant young man and suggests to Leopold that he should go north and study the Kirtland's warbler. Well, Leopold, a couple years later, puts together a group of people and ends up going to northern Michigan to study the Kirtland's warbler. At age 19, he's already graduated from college, and he puts together this group of people, and they find the Kirtland's warbler. They begin to study it. They make a short video of it. He writes a paper that both the movie, the film, and the paper are presented at the American Ornithologist Union meeting later that year in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's the first person to recognize the connection between the brown-headed cowbird and the Kirtland's warbler. And in his paper, he says that the Kirtland's warbler, he recognizes the threat and says that the Kirtland's warbler could very well go extinct because of the impact of the brown-headed cowbird. So the following year, he's back in Chicago with his friend Richard Loeb, and they decide that they're going to attempt to commit the perfect murder. After a string of minor crimes, they decide that they think that they're so smart that they can get away with committing a murder and not get caught. So they did it for the love of it. And of course, they were caught because Nathan Leopold had a pair of glasses with a unique hinge, and they fell out of his pocket where they dumped the poor boy's body. And the police found the pair of glasses, and this led them to Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb. Eventually, they pleaded guilty and were sentenced to life plus 99 years in prison. But even in prison, birds were not far away from Nathan Leopold's thoughts. And when he was in northern Michigan, he collected a Kirtland's warbler nest and the surrounding area around the nest and took it back to Chicago to go on display at the Field Museum. So the family chauffeur, because he was from a wealthy family, the family chauffeur was able to drive the finished display after it had been preserved down to Stateville Prison, where Leopold was allowed to admire it for a half hour in the warden's office. I'm sure that was probably a highlight for him, living in a fairly dreary prison existence. But after he's released from prison in the 1960s, He moves to Puerto Rico, but returns to northern Michigan on at least two occasions that I've been able to document to see the bird that he refers to as my old friend, the Kirtland's warbler. I remember one of the foresters telling me a story about meeting Nathan Leopold. He was a young forester at the time. He's called into the boss's office. The supervisor says, "Bill, I'd like you to meet this man. He wants to see the Kirtland's warbler. His name's Nathan Leopold. Could you take him out to see the Kirtland's warbler, please?" And Bill Irvine thinks, "Nathan Leopold. Nathan Leopold, why do I recognize that name?" He didn't quite make the connection. He just knew that the bells were ringing. He knew that name from someplace. So they're bouncing down a dirt road in northern Michigan in a pickup truck. And there's Nathan Leopold sitting next to him. When the bells turn into a klaxon, he realizes who this is sitting next to him. And the way he told the story just made me laugh, because he's driving down the road and he realizes who's sitting next to him. There's a famous murderer sitting next to him. He says, "Now I know who you are." Nathan Leopold was one of the most important and influential people in the history of Kirtland's warbler research. His paper is still cited today as being one of the most important pieces of research.
And the exhibit he created, is that still on display somewhere?
Unfortunately, no. It was given to the Field Museum on temporary loan, and before Leopold died, he decided to donate it to Cranbrook, the Cranbrook Institution down here in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. And no one at Cranbrook seems to know where it is these days.
Oh, my goodness. Let's take a call. Jim Olson in Traverse City is on the phone. Good morning, Jim.
Yeah, good morning, Peter.
Go ahead.
Well, what a wonderfully interesting program. I have to pick up the book. I have a question. What effect does fragmentation of the jack pine or habitat for the Kirtland warbler due to its population, if anything? And I think a secondary point would be, does fragmentation interfere with the trapping of the cowbird and therefore disturb the efforts that are going on? I'm just curious, as those of us are concerned about the state of lands and the management conflicts to go on with all the multiple uses.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you for your call, Jim. Yes, I'll take the second one first. The fragmentation has no impact, as far as I know, on cowbird trapping. The fragmentation does have a big impact, however, on Kirtland's warbler nesting. Kirtland's warbler would prefer large areas of young jack pine. The bigger, the better. And if you have small areas, this was one of the things that the biologists learned early on in the 1960s and 70s, is that even though they were planting areas for the Kirtland's warbler was generally rejecting them simply because they weren't large enough. So fragmentation is important. The other thing you have to remember is that jack pines reproduce because of fire. And because of the randomness of wildfire, the biologists weren't following the fire patterns that were established that generated regrowth in odd ways. So there would be large areas of young jack pines, but then there would also be large areas and smaller areas of deciduous trees or open areas mixed in to that jack pine area. So if you want to attract Kirtland's warblers to an area, you need a very large area, but it needs to mimic areas created by wildfire. They like little openings. So what they're doing today to attract Kirtland's warblers is they're planting large areas, but they're planting them in a special way with sort of an opposing wave pattern. A tractor will go through and cut furrows in the ground, and they will leave about 1-acre-size football-shaped openings that won't get planted. And those areas will be open to the undergrowth, the sweet ferns, and the blueberries. And those blueberries provide an important food for the Kirtland's warbler.
Thank you. How large is an area? What's considered to be a sufficiently large area.
Anything less than 40 acres is not good enough.
Okay. Well, boy, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jim. And
yeah, thank you.
Let me add here, Bill, I had an email from someone saying the DNR has been destroying a lot of habitat for this bird. Is there any way in which the DNR could be accused of that?
I'm not sure exactly what the emailer is referring to, but the thing that has to be remembered is that the Kirtland's warbler likes young jack pine trees. So once the trees get more than 20 years old, those trees, that stretch of jack pine is no longer used. So if you see a tract of jack pines, you can say, well, there's a tract of jack pines. The Kirtland's warbler must nest in there. Well, no, that's not the case, because if they're mature jack pines, there are no Kirtland's warblers in there.
Okay, and the emailer did not provide much more information. So let me ask, I mean, the reason I called you this week and invited you on the show is the issue is now looming in the near future where the bird will be taken off the endangered species list, and a number of questions then arise about how to keep doing all the things people are doing for it to help it sustain its population level. Is this just a question of money and the dollars that have been coming from U.S. Fish and Wildlife will no longer be there when it's not an endangered animal, or is it about more than money?
It's about more than money. It is, unlike other endangered species that have come off the endangered species list, the wolf, the bald eagle, you name it, the Kirtland's warbler is going to continue to require human intervention. We've taken fire out of the northern Michigan habitat. We no longer allow jack pine to reproduce naturally because of fire. So what we have to do is we have to create new habitat for the Kirtland's warbler. And in many ways, it's creating habitat for many other species, too. You have to remember that deer hunter loved the jack pine management because they're getting more deer in the area. Snowshoe hare hunters love jack pine management because they're getting more snowshoe hares in the area. So it's more than just Kirtland's warbler management, but they continue, both the U.S. Forest Service and the Michigan DNR will need to continue to create new habitat simply because we can't allow fire to sweep across northern Michigan like it did in the 17th, 18th centuries. So it's a conservation-reliant species, and that's an important idea. So in order to create this new paradigm for endangered species management, we need to get people in a room together and say, how are we going to do this, and what are we going to do? And in many ways, we're going to have to make decisions the same way that the biologists did when they were making decisions on how to protect the bird. We're going to be making decisions sort of by the seat of our pants and hope that they work out. We don't have anything to go by because there's no other species like the Kirtland's warbler that has come off the endangered species list so far. All the other species, as I said, they're not conservation reliant. Once they came off the endangered species list, they just took off and they did not need help from humans anymore. The Kirtland's warbler is going to require that help into the future.
Let me squeeze a call in here real quick. We're almost to the end of our time. But Catherine in Thompsonville, go ahead real quickly, Catherine.
Hi there.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
We can. If you can make it quick, we're close to the end of this.
I will. I purchased property here at the end of a private drive. I purchased it because it backs up to 40 acres of red pine. Now, there are many other sections around that are not too far away that are also state or DNR surveyed properties. I purchased it because there are a lot of jack pines along the fringe of this woods and growing into the woods, because when you clear a jack pine forest, you know, they thin it out, then it lets a little sunlight in and the jacks get what they need. Well, I have been taking the ones that die and bend over in the winter, like I have some now, from the pressure of the snow, and I cut them and lay them out so that I can build more areas with jacks. I like jack pines. They actually protect the roots, I think, from the sun, from the west and south side of this woods. the jack pine roots. They play a big position there. But
okay,
also,
Catherine, if you can move to the point, because we have just a little bit of time.
The point is, I need someone to do what I've been trying to do, which is to keep the DNR from destroying this area. Okay, now I'm doing what I can to develop jack pines, but it's a prime area. There are open spaces, I believe. I need someone to come look at it. I've already spoken to the DNR. They've marked the red pine woods to cut them. I don't know if that's a good idea, considering this. There is a glacial basin in this woods that is a like a small pond that's gone through succession, and now it's a protective area. There are jacks growing around that.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah. Okay. So you're saying, Catherine, yeah. the DNR is having logging done on these red pine stands.
Well, they are around this area. In the last year, there was a lot of cutting going on. So I called the DNR and pleaded with them not to cut this wood because I see how it's working, and it is actually the jacks are growing.
Have you actually seen warblers in those stands, heard a warbler? And a yes or no, and then I have to let Bill talk, and then we've got to wrap this up.
I really don't know what it looks like. I'm apologetic about that, but I think that this area is a good spot for that, and it's because I'm protecting the jacks.
Okay,
and
great.
I'm helping them grow.
Thanks. All right. Thanks for the call, Bill. What do you say?
One of the things you have to remember about the jack pine is that the seeds will not open out of the pine cone unless there's fire to open that.
About red pine, which
right.
you had mentioned used by birds in Wisconsin.
Right. But she also mentioned that she was cutting the jack pines and laying them down, and the jack pines will not regenerate unless there's fire to open that cone. The cone is sealed with a serotonin coating, and that only opens in tremendous heat of fire. So just to cut a jack pine and lay it down so that the pine cones will open, that's not going to happen, unfortunately. The trees will not generate that way.
And this very quickly, but the current fire regime, I wish we had had time to talk about the Mack Lake fire and everything that meant for the bird and management in the future. The forests are becoming drier. Are we really going to be able to maintain this complete fire suppression, do you think?
Your guess is as good as mine. We've had fire suppression, of course, because there are so many people and so much private property now in northern Michigan that we simply can't not let fire run across the landscape as it did 200, 300 years ago.
It's just too fragmented.
It's too fragmented, and there's too much private property and too many people. We certainly don't want to lose lives.
All right.
Go
ahead. Finish that thought.
The question is, if climate change models are true, what's going to happen to those forests in the future?
All right. Well, Bill, thanks for your time this morning. It's a fascinating book and great to talk to you.
Thank you, Peter.
It's Bill Rapay, and his book is The Kirtland's Warbler, the story of a bird's fight against extinction and the people who saved it. It's from the University of Michigan Press, and it was a Michigan Notable Book in 2012. I'm Peter Payette, and this is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio.